I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, protests rage across the streets of Hong Kong against the Chinese government. The living conditions and economic inequities in Hong Kong have led to living spaces known as coffin homes. There are evidently, people more or less living in cages, and the youth of Hong Kong have reacted with fury and indignation. I first became aware of the Hong Kong protests when news broke that protesters were using lasers against the police and to disable surveillance cameras. Something which definitely gave me a chuckle. As someone both skeptical of China and having a general affinity for protesters, I have generally seen the Hong Kong protests in a positive light. However, this is Parallax Views we're talking about. And I want to bring on a guest that will provide a counterbalance to that view, namely Carl Zha of the Silk and Still podcast, which covers all manner of issues related to China, including its history, culture, and current position on the grand chessboard of geopolitics. News recently broke that the Hong Kong protesters, the youths in the streets, are actually calling upon Donald Trump's help, which leads one to wonder whether the Hong Kong protests have a similarity to France's Yellow Vests protests, in that the ideology of the protesters is not necessarily clear. And a lot more is going on there. Carl and I talk a little bit about that, the possible nativist elements within the Hong Kong protests, and much more on this timely edition of Parallax Views. And yes, we do talk about Steve Bannon's recent support for the protesters, in case you were wondering. And now, on to my conversation with Carl Zha of the Silk and Still podcast on the Hong Kong protests. Welcome to Parallax Views, Carl Zha of the Silk and Still podcast. How are you doing, Carl?
Thank you for inviting me. I'm doing great. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, Carl, maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar with Silk and Still, although you get a great number of listeners for the podcast, maybe you could describe the podcast and what it sort of deals with for my listeners that may be unfamiliar.
Oh, sure. My podcast, the Silk and Steel podcast, primarily focus on everything China related. So history, culture, current events, especially pertaining to the current Hong Kong protests. I do have a lot of coverage. And also pop culture. I did an interview with a bunch of guys who does movie reviews for Chinese blockbusters. So pretty much anything China related, I will cover on my podcast.
And what is your background? Because I know listeners are going to be curious, and you know, since we're going to be talking about the Hong Kong protests, they're going to accuse us of things like bias, and they'll say, "Oh, well, where's his allegiances?" So let's get that out of the way, so you know our listeners yes. can know and not, you know, go crazy and whatnot.
Yes, yes. I will come clean about my background. I was born in China in 1976, mainland China. I grew up there until I was 13 years old, and then I came to United States in 1990, just 1 year after the Tiananmen Square protest. So I live about 29 years now in U.S., but I spent my formative years in China, and I am, I'm still plugged into the Chinese social media. I still have my extended families on mainland. So I'm just a China geek. I try to absorb any information I can about China. So this is a topic I feel very passionate about. Currently, now the current hotspot is, of course, Hong Kong. So, I mean, hopefully this brief background gives your audience an idea where my perspectives come from.
Well, let's get that perspective. What exactly are the Hong Kong protests really about? Because, I mean, we have sort of Western media coverage of it, and we have people like Steve Bannon now of sort of right wing Breitbart and Trump fame coming in on it, and it's very, very confusing, I think, right now, because there's so many different perspectives on it. What's your take on it?
Yes, yes. There are a lot of confusions about Hong Kong, primarily because of lack of knowledge in the West about Hong Kong or China in general. And what really is driving the protest is, I think, a sense of anxiety and unease a lot of the Hong Kongers feel about their future, particularly a future under PRC, under China, because as we all know, Hong Kong was a British colony since 1840s, and it has been handed over to China finally in 1997. And since then, it has been operating under what's known as one country, two system rule. So there will be one set of rules for mainland China. You know, China promised it will not impose its socialist system and governance onto Hong Kong, and Hong Kong will retain its famously so-called free-willing capitalism, just as it had before under the British colonial rule. That was a deal, and now, you know, China had promised in 1984, in the joint Sino-British declaration, that the way of things in Hong Kong will not change for 50 years after the handover. So that is from 1997 to 2047. And now we're only, 28 years away from that date. And so people in Hong Kong are getting a little bit anxious about what that means. And you know, because Hong Kong is very different, is run differently from mainland China. You know, it does not have a great firewall, of course. It does have freedom of press, freedom of assembly. As we have seen, there have been continued protests for the last 2 months now, since June. And people, you know, it's driven by fear, I would say, because the original trigger for the Hong Kong protest ostensibly was the extradition bill that would allow people to be extradited to mainland China for crimes committed on mainland China. And this came about because there was a famous case where this the Hong Kong couple, they went over to Taiwan, where the guy killed his pregnant Hong Kong girlfriend in Taiwan and then fled back to Hong Kong. And because there's no extradition treaty between Hong Kong and Taiwan, and because the under Hong Kong law, he cannot be persecuted for a crime he committed outside of Hong Kong, the Hong Kong police cannot hold him, you know, on the murder charges. They actually detain him because he used his girlfriend's money to purchase a cell phone after, you know, killing her. And so the Hong Kong police detained him for theft, right? Like, they can't hold him indefinitely for theft. And there's currently no mechanism to get him extradited to Taiwan to stand trial for this heinous crime. That's what's was driven the original spark that made the extradition bill come to pass in the Hong Kong legislature, you know, but it was first proposed. But because the special status of Hong Kong, because Hong Kong since 1997 has been territory of People's Republic of China, and because People's Republic of China claims jurisdiction over Taiwan, and because Hong Kong does not have extradition treaty with either Taiwan or mainland China, that this proposed extradition bill would cover all both mainland China and Taiwan, right? And what you know, there was a lot of fear whipped up by the Hong Kong media about this extradition bill. I mean, people were saying, oh, this is a kind of a backdoor for China to extend its authoritarian rule into Hong Kong, because now maybe political dissenters will be extradited back to mainland for trial. But in fact, the bill was very specific. The bill said the you know, political crimes would not be covered under the extradition treaty, and the case for extradition will only be evaluated on case by case basis at the discretion of Hong Kong judges. You know, Hong Kong judge would decide who to be allowed for extradition, who not to be. I mean, there were a lot of safeguard built into the bill, but you know, this whole bill has been a trigger for this protest. And now we know it's really a trigger because the Hong Kong governor, Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam, just a few days ago has formally announced on TV that the bill will be withdrawn, which was the original demand of the protesters. But the protest goes on because now after 2 months of protest, the demands has grown, and now the protesters are demanding all five demands be met before they back down from the protest, which is where we are now.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because I guess the latest development, and this has been just in the past few hours, CNBC writes, Hong Kong protesters waving U.S. flags appeal to Trump to, quote, liberate their city. Washington Post writes, Hong Kong tells U.S. to stay out. Students form protest chains. It seems like things are continuing onward.
Yeah. I mean, this is a path of escalation ever since the protest starting in June. I mean, in the beginning, they did have a huge turnout in June, a peaceful protest. Initially was reported by media as 1 million march. They claim a turnout of 1 million men, but actually several weeks later, Reuters has come out with image analysis revealing that it was actually more like 250,000.
Right? Wasn't there also a Netflix documentary that the Hong Kong protesters were really big into?
Yes, yes. So this just happened on August 29th. I believe it's August 29th. There was 40 screening of this Netflix documentary called Winter on Fire, which is a documentary on the Maidan protest in Ukraine in, I believe, 2014, that overthrew the previous Ukrainian government. And I watched a BBC, news footage of the Hong Kong protesters and the Hong Kong protesters protest supporters going to watch the film. And this young woman were getting very emotional after the viewing, and she was crying and saying, "Oh, I really hope, you know, Hong Kong can have this similar happy ending as Ukraine." And I was thinking, oh my God, do you even know what happened in Ukraine after the color revolution? I mean, the Ukraine is pretty much a failed state right now. It went through civil war, you know, neo-Nazis.
Yeah, weren't we basically backing, I think it was the Azov Battalion, like literal neo-Nazi groups.
Yes, yes. I mean, that the Azov Battalion was one of the forces that the Ukrainian government relied upon to wage the civil war against the against the people in East Ukraine demanding self rule. So yeah, I mean, like, I can see why a lot of people are being misled, because, you know, Hong Kong is a place that, on one hand, it does not have the Great Firewall that separates it from the general outside world, but it also means it's been flooded constantly by kind of the Western liberal media narratives. And one of that narratives is Ukraine, right? If the only thing you know about Ukraine is that somehow they fought for their freedom and they won, right? And as how it was presented in this Netflix documentary, you know, they come to identify with that. Oh, like, this is basically what we're fighting for. We're also fighting for freedom. In fact, in the BBC footage, the BBC Chinese footage, one man interview literally made the comparison. He said, well, you know, like, we all know what Ukraine is fighting for. You know, Ukraine was basically against Russia. We all understand what Russia stood for. You know, like, we here in Hong Kong, we're fighting against China, mainland China, and we also know, you know, China stood for. So there's the association is already being made, you know, by this common fight against authoritarianism, you know, and that the both struggles, Ukraine and Hong Kong, is just a struggle for democracy and freedom, or at least how it's being portrayed in the Western media.
Do you think there's any legitimate grievances to the Hong Kong protests and also criticisms of China?
Oh yeah, I mean, there are some real issues in Hong Kong society, particularly after the handover. One problem is the high housing prices, because Hong Kong government derived most of its revenue from land sales. Because since the British colonial days, you know, basically all land in Hong Kong technically belonged to the government. And so how the government raised money is parse out small plot of land each year, sell them off to developers, and that's, you know, that way Hong Kong government can keep the taxes down, makes the business happy, right? And it's also come from the drive during the, because at the time, the British Empire demanded all its colonies to be self-sustaining. So that has been the way it's done in Hong Kong ever since, you know, 1840s. And the consequence of that is, despite Hong Kong has a lot of empty land, this is something people don't realize. If you ever, for people who ever traveled to Hong Kong, they will see this. You know, as you take the airport express train from the airport to Hong Kong Island, you will see there's a lot of green, empty space in Hong Kong. But government hold on to this land and ration them in a way to artificially jack up the land price and by extension the real estate price. And they do this in collusion with the real estate tycoons in Hong Kong, who are some of the wealthiest men in the territory. You know, the top 10 wealthiest men in Hong Kong, most of them are real estate developers.
Does this relate at all to what's been called the coffin homes in Hong Kong? The sort of, I mean, I've heard that people are more or less living in cages at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there were literally dwellings that are like cages in Hong Kong because, you know, like, because most of the housing development was restricted to small plots of land. So they try to cram as much space as possible. And the rental price is so ridiculous that you pretty much, you know, squeeze out all the working class Hong Kongers. Yes, people live in very, very cramped spaces, and some even live in cages. Yes, that's true. And these are the things that, you know, legitimate grievances that Hong Kongers have. Because one consequence of the handover is that, you know, China promised in the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration that China will not impose its rule on Hong Kong. So what that means is that all the colonial structure of Hong Kong gets preserved. And on top of that, all the, you know, so the handover, and in essence, was a handover from like the power of the British colonial governor. It was handover to a legislature and the government that's dominated by the local Hong Kong elite, the tycoons. And, you know, it's these tycoons, they all literally own Hong Kong. They own the land. They own the properties upon which they build, you know, dwellings for the Hong Kongers. They also bought up all the Hong Kong utilities. So, you know, water, gas, even transport, even a bus that the Hong Kongers take, they're all owned by the tycoons. So Hong Kongers live and die to make money for these tycoons.
And, can I interject real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, I know in the 1990s, and excuse me if I'm ignorant about this. I want you to sort of inform me. I know in the 1990s, the triads, organized crime was very involved in the private sector in Hong Kong. Is that still the case today? Or are they involved with these tycoons, or is that off base?
Well, the underground mafia or triad, that they have been very much mainstay of the Hong Kong economy since the very beginning. And nowadays are more, you know, some of them try to be, you know, going respectable, you know, going to business holdings and stuff. But
I hear that's very similar in Russia now. There's a lot that have tried to go mainstream.
Yes. I mean, it's the same everywhere, really. I mean, but yes, the mafia, the tycoons, you know, they're all kind of inhabit the same ecosystem in Hong Kong. And in a way, you know, because China took a largely hands-off approach to Hong Kong, like the tycoons, the triads, they pretty much have a free reign. And so that in combination of that is economic transformation in Hong Kong, because, you know, for a while, Hong Kong originally during its takeoff, it started off as a manufacturing hub, right, and making, you know, cheap shoes and use the cheap labor. You know, back in the days, there were a lot of cheap labor in Hong Kong because there were a lot of refugees from the mainland that came to Hong Kong as a result of Chinese Civil War and the Great Famine. And on top of that, there's these capitalist tycoons who escaped Shanghai during the communist takeover. So they brought their capital to Hong Kong, and then all the refugees provided the cheap labor. And then the Hong Kong started off as like a manufacturing center. And then back by 1980s, 1990s, you know, China started its own opening and reform. So, which means the Chinese market was thrown open. So all the Hong Kong capitalists now take their capital, go across the border to set up factories in China to take advantage of even cheaper laborers over there. And all the manufacturing of Hong Kong got hollowed out as they moved to China. And so what Hong Kong got left with is finance and real estate. Right. We already talk about real estate as being a problem. And, you know, the highly financial nature of Hong Kong, you know, making it turning into a service industry also meant that, you know, the wealth tend to accrue at the top. So in a way, what the Hong Kong youth is facing today, it's not that different from what millennial is facing in the West or in United States, Canada or Europe.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, I feel like the trajectory of America, if we look towards places like the Silicon Valley, there's a lot of similarities between what is happening in Hong Kong and a lot of the sort of metropolitan or cosmopolitan areas of the U.S. right now. And I think it's going to keep happening in the U.S., actually.
Yeah, I mean, Hong Kong just took it to because the dominance of the tycoons in politics, and this is part of the reason why, you know, Hong Kong youth particularly felt that they are voiceless, that they are kind of helpless to change the society, and so these are the legitimate discontent and legitimate grievances for these Hong Kong youth. And the extradition bill protests actually provided them an outlet, right, to air out these discontent. What they are demanding, you know, originally was just withdrawing extradition bill, but the demands quickly expanded. You know, some of the demands are related to the protest itself. Is a withdrawal government's characterization of the protests as riot, amnesty for all the protesters, for the protest related charges, but most importantly, it's the demand for universal suffrage for both the chief executive officer of Hong Kong and as well as for the Hong Kong legislature, right? So, I mean, these are actually not unreasonable demands. I mean, especially how can you be against universal suffrage, right? I mean, I think universal suffrage is a good thing. But, right, and now we have, we come into, this is where the conflict gets built up, because, you know, from the Chinese central government's perspective, right, since 1984, since the Sino-British Joint Declaration, the deal was, you know, Hong Kong is going to remain the same as is, and only requirement that China is that Hong Kong does not get to turn into an anti-China platform, Right. So China, the Chinese central government is not technically against the universal suffrage in Hong Kong, but it wants a safety clause that to make sure that whoever gets elected as the chief executive in Hong Kong will not be someone who is anti-China, right? So in the Hong Kong's basic mini-constitution, basic law, the path for eventual universal suffrage was actually guaranteed. The details is in the implementation. So just a few years ago, there was a plan that was proposed in Hong Kong legislature on implementing universal suffrage, basically to satisfy both the demands for universal suffrage and the Chinese central government's concern that Hong Kong does not get turned into an anti-China platform. It put in a clause says, the chief executive that's getting elected needs to be approved by a vetting committee, right? And so that actually, or the candidates needs to be approved by a vetting committee. And a lot of Hong Kongers feel that is not a true universal suffrage system. It's kind of, they feel like that basically is Beijing's way of getting its own favorite candidate in place. So they rejected that proposal as some kind of Trojan horse by Beijing to implement its will on Hong Kong. So what we ended up with is we still don't have true universal suffrage, because during the colonial rule of Hong Kong, British never granted democracy to Hong Kong. And it's only after 1984, after Britain agreed to hand Hong Kong over to China, that's when they belatedly started limited democratic reform, which is they set up these limited electoral votes for Hong Kong Legislative Council. But it's not a one man, one vote system. It's based on blocks. You know, they set up certain blocks for the business, for lawyers and doctors, and it's that system, the partial democracy system, that has kind of get grandfathered in after the handover after 1997, and this is a system currently in Hong Kong. But the Hong Kong Constitution promised that eventually, you know, it's gonna gradually move to a full universal suffrage system. But there's a lot of arguments on how that will be achieved, right? And because these arguments, you know, really it's kind of tussle of war between China's concern that that anti-China forces will somehow take over Hong Kong versus, you know, Hong Kongers resist any kind of inputs from the Chinese central government. And now we're at an impasse where, you know, there's really haven't been any concrete step forward for further implementation of universal suffrage. And this is one of the big demand of the current protest is universal suffrage, right? And so this also goes to why people are appealing to United States, why the Hong Kongers, some Hong Kongers are appealing to United States, because they feel, the U.S. liberal media narrative is pretty much is very dominant in Hong Kong. So people bought into the narrative that U.S. is the beacon of democracy and it stands for freedom and democracy. So people in Hong Kong, they want U.S., you know, this beacon of democracy to come in and basically to help them to achieve universal suffrage system in Hong Kong. Yeah, go ahead.
So I was going to ask, I take it a lot of these protesters may be a bit younger, and may not have lived under the period of British colonial rule in Hong Kong. Is that correct? And could you maybe expand on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Because if you look at the Hong Kong protests right now, it's overwhelmingly skewed to the youth, to the teenager, to the college crowd. And most of those people are either born or grow up after 1997 handover. Like, they have no memories of the British colonial days. And to them, because they don't have real memories of the British colonial days, so to them, you know, only life they have known is a Hong Kong after 1997 and the handover. So to them, the British colonial day became this kind of mythical golden age where everything seems to be better, right? Because it's not the present, which they detest. They don't like the present. And so they project kind of their own projections into this golden age of British colonial past. And that goes to another point, is there's actually a big generation divide in Hong Kong right now regarding to the support of the protests. You know, it's not just in the media, it's often portrayed as Hong Kongers versus the Chinese central government. It's not quite the case. Right now, is the Hong Kong is divided, and the divide is very much generational. The younger folks are overwhelmingly supporting the protests, whereas the older folks, the people who have actually lived under the British colonial rule, are much more reserved or outright against the protest. And because, you know, the older generation, they have gone through a lot, and the overwhelming sentiment from this generation is that, you know, Hong Kong has been pretty good. You know, we've seen our life improve in our lives, and why are you jeopardizing this life we have, right? I mean, in a way, kind of analogous to U.S., you know, you have this older generation of people who are doing pretty well financially, like the boomer generation, right?
Right. I was just going to say, you have the boomers that are kind of coasting right now, maybe a little bit less after the 08 financial crisis, but still generally coasting much more than, say, the millennials, people my age or younger, with the Generation Z, or what they're being called now, the Zoomers.
Yeah. But the thing is, my point is, the Hong Kong people have some legitimate demand and legitimate grievances, but during this expression of their demand and their airing of their grievances, a lot of the time this anger is being misredirected toward immigrants, toward particularly mainland Chinese immigrant, right? I mean, it's not enough they're against the mainland China's government. It's now that a lot of the anger is being directed toward ordinary mainland Chinese people, you know, even the not just migrant, but also just tourists, right? It's kind of like how, you know, what we've seen in the United States, the kind of the economic uncertainty and anxiety since the Great Recession has really, you know, hit the working class America. And a lot of time these discontent is getting redirected to Mexican immigrants, you know, to Latino immigrants, because it's so much easier to blame the problems of the society on the immigrants, you know, especially when you don't want to, when you don't want to point out maybe the class is a problem, you know, you don't want to focus on the class aspect of it. You just, you just blame outsiders. It's a tribal thing, and it's so much easier. And that's what happened in Hong Kong right now, is a lot of, in a rush to kind of delineate themselves from China, because granted, Hong Kong does have its unique history, its unique experience as a British colony, and as an international city, that people feel that, one common complaint you hear from the Hong Kong protester is that we don't want to become just another Chinese city. I mean, I don't know. I guess it must be very terrible to become just another Shanghai. But that's how people feel on the ground. They feel like, you know, we want to preserve the uniqueness of Hong Kong, right? But in doing so, they often just turn anti-China and anti-everything Chinese. Like I said, not just Chinese government, but also average mainland Chinese people. Even the tourists who come to Hong Kong get castigated for, you know, overcrowding the markets, you know, like just buying up everything. I don't understand it, right? Because for one thing, I thought tourism is a good thing, but apparently there are a lot of locals who are, against mainland tourism. And so the Hong Kong media does not help either. You know, one of the biggest tabloids circulating in Hong Kong, Apple Daily, is owned by Jimmy Lai, who is very ostensibly anti-China. And in Apple Daily, they run a lot of stories, basically highlighting the misbehaving mainland tourists, you know, like highlighting all the negative aspects. Oh, you know, so-and-so mainlanders is having their babies peeing and pooping on the train, or like a lot of these things get blown up and highlighted in the media. And in fact, in 2012, you know, there was a famous incident when some nativist Hong Konger group took out a full page ad in Apple Daily. It portrayed the Hong Kong in the background, but with this giant locust poised to take over. And it says, "Hong Kongers, don't you have enough?" I mean, it's literally calling the mainland Chinese locusts. And it says, "Hong Konger, don't you have enough that you are paying 1 million Hong Kong dollars, you know, every 18 minutes to support this pregnant mainland woman coming over the border to deliver babies," right? I mean, this is like the same talking points about anchor babies we have now in United States. It's the same anti-immigrant talking point. And except it's a lot more blatant in Hong Kong, because, you know, the mainlanders were openly being called locusts. There was even a song called "The Locust World." I think somebody put it on YouTube and even put English subtitles, so people can Google it. They can Google "Locust World," the song, you know, from Hong Kong, and they will find it. It's very disgusting. And this is why I am personally, I'm not standing the protest, because, you know, like I said before, I was born on mainland. I was born and raised there. And now, you know, these young Hong Kongers, they're trying to define themselves as different from Chinese, that they've taken to call the mainland Chinese people locusts. And they even called the mainland Chinese people a World War II Japanese racial epithet for the Chinese people. In Japanese, it's called Shina, right? And it originally was a neutral, long time ago, it was a neutral term for China, but during the Japanese invasion, it became a really bad derogatory term for the Chinese. And the closest English equivalent would be Chink. But now these Hong Kong, young Hong Kong protesters in an effort to define themselves as different, as something not Chinese, they turn to call mainland Chinese people Chink, you know, in Chinese. And these are the things I'm just really turn me off. And I hope you can understand why I'm not too hot on the protest itself.
Well, you know, I was going to say, I'm one of these people that, you know, when I initially looked at the protests, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. They're disabling surveillance cameras with laser pointers. And like, I usually want to, you know, back the protesters, but this seems like it's very similar to the situation in France with the yellow vests, where you have a lot of these protesters have extremely far right and nativist sympathies. And that to me is very concerning.
Yeah, I mean, I think yellow vest is a good analogy, because yellow vest is another mass movement that did not have a clear ideology. So it drew people from all walks of life. You have, you know, leftist, but then you also have the far right nationalists all converge into the same movement. But what happened is, you know, like in a movement without clear ideology, right? It's always the most radical people that most aggressive radical people that tend to take over. And that's what's happening in Hong Kong right now. I mean, people saying, okay, come on, you know, millions of people turned out. There's no way CIA could organize a million people on the street, right? But that's not what I'm saying. You know, like Hong Kong protest is obviously a mass movement because there's some legitimate underlying grievances. But guess what? These protesters are not out there to protesting against the tycoons who are actually causing them all these economic miseries, forcing them to live in cramped apartments, forcing these 20-year-old who to live with their parents until they're 30 because they can't afford their own housing. And so instead, what they're turning their anger, you know, into this like nativist direction. And a lot of the I said before, I support universal suffrage for Hong Kongers, right? Because I believe universal suffrage is a good thing. But, you know, like right now, the people are, you know, the media, especially the Western media, you know, they never report on the ugly side of the protest, you know, the ugly nativism side of the protest, because the media loves a simple narrative. They love this narrative of this David versus Goliath, right? These plucky Hong Kong youth who stood up for freedom and democracy against this encroaching big bad authoritarian China, right? That's out there to crush them. But this is not what's happening right now. I mean, you know, so far the Chinese central government has not intervened directly. It's letting the Hong Kong government and the Hong Kong police to handle things. And right now it's really what's not being reported in Western media is it's really dividing Hong Kong itself right now. I mean, Hong Kong is, there was a poll recently by Minpo, one of the Hong Kong Chinese language newspaper, that this actually happened a month ago. This poll so it might be different now. Back then, the poll was talking about basically the how do you feel about the violence in the protest. You know, it was 43% against versus 50% approve. So at that time, you know, with 50%, 43%, I mean, that's a close even divide. And even though at that time there was a clear edge towards a pro-protest side. And also given the fact that the Hong Kong media has been basically overwhelmingly anti-Beijing since 1989 Tiananmen Square protest, right? That's another thing. Like people don't realize is, you know, Hong Kong actually does have genuine press freedom. Because especially in, you know, if you go read the Hong Kong English news media, like the South China Morning Post, which actually got bought over by Alibaba recently, like a couple of years ago. But Jack Ma promised that they he will allow editorial independence. And so far, it looks like that's the case, because if you look at the SCMP, South China Morning Post coverage of Hong Kong protests, it's very sympathetic to the protesters. and you know, so I, you know, a lot of the times that the
wasn't it a Hong Kong news channel that recently had Steve Bannon of Trump fame on? I believe it was.
Yeah. I have to look up to which one exactly. But Steve Bannon, you know, he's very chummy with certain Hong Kong tycoons, and especially Jimmy Lai, who I pointed out is the owner of Hong Kong's largest tabloid, Apple Daily. Apple Daily also has a large market share in Taiwan, and you know, the Jimmy Lai is a figure who, you know, came to Washington in July as the protest was, you know, just heating up, and in one day he met with Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, and John Bolton in same day. I mean, he's just a Hong Kong media figure, and he was he was meeting with all these the big neocon trail in Washington, and I want to go back to the point I was making earlier, that it's true that Hong Kong protest is a mass movement. You know, CIA did not motivate all million people to go on the street, but it does not mean a mass movement without clear ideology cannot be manipulated and co-opted. And so often the case, they often do get manipulated and co-opted. And let's face it, Hong Kong was the front line of Cold War, right? So for the longest time, that place was crawling with intelligence agencies from various nations, you know, from Britain, from U.S., even France, and it's, I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that these people are not just idle by watching the protests happen, unfold. And we already have, you know, the political officers of U.S. consulate Judy Edu meeting with a student activist leader, Joshua Wong and Nathan Law, in the lobby of JW Marriott Hotel in Hong Kong. That photo was published. And we also have, in 2014, there was a BBC documentary on Oslo Freedom Forum training the Hong Kong protesters. That was for the earlier protest in 2014, the Hong Kong Occupy movement, or the umbrella movement of Hong Kong. But, you know, Oslo Freedom Forum also trained Dennis Ho, who is currently another, you know, important figurehead or poster child for the current Hong Kong protest. So, like, this information is wide in the open. You know, Oslo Freedom Forum is started by a European right wing tycoon, and it helps to train and finance a various group of these color revolutions from Ukraine to Syria and now Hong Kong. I mean, we also have National Endowment for Democracy, NED, which just a group that was outgrowth from CIA, that's also very much active in Hong Kong. We have Mike Pillsbury, who went on a U.S. TV channel talking about it. So, yeah, of course we're involving Hong Kong. You know, we have National National Endowment for Democracy, NED, handing out money, helping train democracy activists, blah, blah, blah. I mean, he said that as like a very proud badge of honor, but we know U.S. is meddling, you know. One thing U.S. can do very well is through information, you know, through media. Like the West, you know, people must have noticed that Hong Kong protest is getting like 24/7 coverage all over Western press. You know, you don't see that same treatment for yellow vests in France. You don't see that. You don't see any coverage of Haiti protests, you know, Honduras. Everything is in Hong Kong right now. I mean, like, all the world's press corps is in Hong Kong. They're there for a reason. I mean, on one superficial level, it's an understandable reason. It's because Hong Kong is developed. You know, the reporters can check into nice 5-star hotels in Hong Kong, and there was really no real sense of danger. You know, no matter what, despite all these the sensational news stories out of Hong Kong, one thing that needs to be pointed out that from June till now, you know, the two almost 3 months of protests, there have been zero people killed. Right. I mean, there are few cases of suicide and, you know, protesters killing themselves to protest, but there have been zero people killed. I mean, actually, just a couple of days ago, now there's a rumor that the Hong Kong police have supposedly executed 6 protesters inside the Prince Edward Metro station. But I highly doubt that's true, because with the amount of cameras right present in Hong Kong right now, I mean, I don't know if you see these footages. You have these like hordes of reporters with their cameras and cell phones, you know, videotaping everything. And so far it's been, the incident supposedly happened on August 31st. So it's been more than a week now, and they have not named any names of the supposedly victims or any families who came forward to claim them. But it's just a rumor that supposedly people got killed. And now one of the demands is that the metro station produce surveillance footage. But conveniently, on August 31st, at Prince Edward train station, the protesters were smashing all the security cameras because they say those are, you know, surveillance cameras. So now they're demanding the government to release the footage of surveillance that supposedly will show evidence of the police execution of protesters. I don't know. In some way, the protests have kind of degenerated into a political theater. You know, like it's almost seemed like the protesters are looking for martyrs. They need, because especially with the Hong Kong government formally withdrew the extradition bill, which was their original demand. Now they're looking for a reason to continue the protest, and continue they did. I mean, I was actually a little bit surprised. I thought expected the protest to last through the summer while the kids are out of school. But I thought the protest would die down a little bit when the school starts. But that hasn't happened. You know, the protests keep going. And I think it actually, I ask people, think about who benefits from the protests, who benefits from a Hong Kong that's destabilized, right? And, go ahead.
I was going to say, in regards to what I was saying about Bannon earlier, I just looked it up. He's currently working with, and maybe you can fill us in on this, he's currently working with New Tang Dynasty Television, which I believe is related to the, mispronouncing this, Falun Gong.
Yeah, Falun Gong. Yeah, New Tang Dynasty Television is a media arm of Falun Gong. And I don't know if you saw that news article, I think it was NBC, that recently did expose on Falun Gong media. And they apparently took out It's Epoch Times. Epoch Times is another media arm of the Falun Gong, and they're the biggest spender on Facebook ads to promote the QAnon theory. Is that how you say it, QAnon?
Yeah, I was completely unaware of that. Oh my God.
Yeah, they were the biggest promoter of the QAnon theory on Facebook and pumping out pro-Trump ads. I mean, they're just a very shady group. And actually, Falun Gong, they, you know, I always wonder how they get their money, right? They're just basically a Chinese cult now that exists mostly in the diaspora because it's been banned on mainland China. But they have like a multi-million dollar like media empire, and I always wonder how they founded those. And then I read Yasha Levine actually wrote about this in his books, Surveillance Valley, the military origin of the internet. So in his investigation, he found out that Falun Gong was being founded by BBG, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, or formerly Broadcasting Board of Governors. Now it's, I think, called U.S. Media Agency or whatever. It's a U.S. government-funded organization that's basically handing money to Falun Gong, right, to have them form this their media empire. And now they're doing some really shady stuff, like working with all these right-wing people like Steve Bannon. And of course, Falun Gong is very anti-China because they're banned from mainland China itself.
They claim to be censored, and they claim to support human rights and democracy and bringing it to China, I guess.
Yeah. I mean,
I've also heard that they are basically a cult. I've heard that criticism.
They're a cult. Mm-hmm. I mean, like they're I think the closest analogy is like Scientology in US, because a lot of the same teachings, they basically they're against medicine, right? They urge their practitioners from not seeking help from modern medicine. They're trying to heal yourself through meditation and blah blah blah. That's just only one of the minor thing you know that requires their followers to do, but it's run by this the Falun Gong leader. People can you know maybe Google it or look it up on Wikipedia on Falun Gong and the Falun Gong founder. And the Falun Gong founder is just like really wacky guru guy. I mean, he claims some really outrageous. That's a really outrageous claim. If your audience are interested, they can, you know, Google it when they have a chance.
Well, out of curiosity, you know, I'm someone that's willing to be skeptical of China in a lot of areas, but I'm really concerned now that after this Russiagate stuff dies down, I think we're going to see a really dangerous rise in anti-Chinese sentiment in this country. And I think that the Hong Kong protests and the way they're portrayed here in the U.S. Could play a role in that.
Oh, yeah. I think it's already happening. I mean, right now, U.S. and China is in an incipient Cold War. That's basically started by U.S. government. You know, the trade war is just a part of that. And there's some U.S. government official was openly saying that, you know, the trade war wasn't really about trade. It's about decoupling the U.S.-China economy. Because in their mind, that the U.S. and Chinese economy is too intertwined, too interconnected. They want to break that. They want to, you know, force U.S. company to source elsewhere, to move their factory elsewhere. They're not forcing them to move back to the United States. They're just moving to other part of the world, to like Southeast Asia, to Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, basically anywhere but China. And that's a very dangerous trend because, you know, like the underlying premise of that, the, to decouple the U.S. and China economy, is that if some kind of confrontation that heats up, the basically a too closely intertwined economy will kind of tie U.S. hands in its its options of dealing, getting tough, quote unquote, with China, right? So this is what's driving the U.S.-China trade war right now. And a lot of that anti-China sentiment has already been seeped down through the media into the general society. I don't know if you saw that news just like few days ago. There was a big panic at the, I think it was Newark Airport, that somebody yelled, basically the Alaska Airline employee yelled evacuate, and then at the departure gate, and it caused a huge panic because people thought it was a shooter incident. And then it turns out that the incident started because Alaska Airline employee approached a China-born passenger and basically accusing him of being suspicious, together with another China-born passenger nearby. These two people actually don't know each other, but just because they're Chinese, that this Alaska Airline employee thought they're suspicious, and then they call the cops. And she called cops on them, and when the cops came to talk to interview the two passengers, then the employee yelled out, "Oh, we got them!" And then she yelled, "Evacuate!" And then that caused a huge panic in the airport, caused flight delay and everything. I mean, this is just the beginning, I think, of very unfortunate, like, kind of a creeping xenophobia that's happening in the U.S. right now.
Well, I would go even farther than that in some ways. I mean, I think that America-Chinese relations have been... I think there's an odd history there. I mean, I think the U.S., historically we won't talk about things like the Nanking Massacre. We helped cover up the atrocities that the Japanese committed during World War II with Unit 731.
Yeah.
There's so much. I feel like there's just a history of really strained relations.
Yeah, because it's funny because the U.S.-China relations really had its up and down, because back in early 20th century, 1900 was really bad because, during Boxer Rebellion, United States was one of the eight nations. U.S. sent that attacked China. U.S. sent a U.S. Marine actually participated in sack of Beijing. And then, U.S. was very much part of the imperialist powers trying to carve up China. But then during World War II, because U.S. After Pearl Harbor, U.S. suddenly became an ally of China in the fight against Japan, and then the perception of U.S. had like a 180-degree shift in China itself. Suddenly like British and Americans were welcome as friends and heroes and allies rather than before as foreign devils, and then that shifted again, after after Korean War, after during the Cold War, and then again in 1980s. Now that's the period I remember, because I grew up in China in 1980s. That after Nixon visited China, especially after Deng Xiaoping visited United States in 1979, there was a brief period of honeymoon between U.S. and China. So in 1980s, relationship generally was very good. People in China, older Americans who have visited China in the 80s will remember this. At the time, the Chinese populace, Chinese people, are very pro-American in the 1980s. And because it seems like, China was aligned with U.S. This time was, in the Cold War against Soviet Union, and also, you know, at the time that, you know, a lot of the a cooperation between China and U.S. during World War II were remembered, and you know, people, so generally people are in China were pro-American. Even after 1989 Tiananmen Square incident, all the way through, I would say, mid-90s, like mid to late 90s. I mean, in the mid-90s, it was an incident where a Chinese ship, a Costco container ship going to the Persian Gulf, was accused by United States of shipping chemical weapon ingredients to Iran, and then U.S. Navy surrounded the ship and eventually forced the ship to dock in Saudi Arabia to accept inspection. And after the inspection by joint U.S. Saudi officials, they found nothing, and they let the ship go. But the saga lasted near a month. You know, on the sea and at the port, and you know, that from that point, you know, the Chinese public's opinions of U.S. began to sour, and follow that by you know, the 1998 bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, and you know, in U.S. media, that's largely explained as an accident. You know, CIA found a outdated map, but nobody in China believed that. And after the bombing of embassy in 1998 was followed by the Hainan spy plane incident in 2001. So that was early 2001 when Donald Rumsfeld ordered increased surveillance planes to China, to South China Sea. And so they had that, finally they had an incident where the U.S. spy plane collided with a Chinese fighter plane and causing the Chinese fighter plane to crash. And so that series, so already in late 90s and early 2000s, U.S. and China were on a path to clash, I mean, kind of pushed by the neocons such as Rumsfeld. But only thing that made U.S. veer off that path is 9/11, you know, because in late 2001, after 9/11, U.S. suddenly shift course from a confrontation with China to intervening in Middle East, you know, to first Afghanistan and then Iraq, and we're still in Afghanistan right now, and it's really during this time, while U.S. is occupied in Middle East, you know, that didn't really have time to restart its confrontation with China, that China was able to use that time to concentrate on its own development. So by 2008, you know, Beijing Olympics came around, and suddenly people were surprised. Wow, you know, China is not what we thought it was, you know, like a very poor, underdeveloped third world country anymore. And 2008 also happened to coincide with the Great Recession, you know, the financial crisis in U.S. So there's a lot of anxiety in U.S. itself, you know, about the uncertain economic future. And I think a lot of the anxiety gets projected, right, by politicians just blame everything on China, right? Like this fear of China can being whipped up, and I think since then, you know, we have been steadily on this path of you know, just confrontation with China, because it didn't start with Trump. It started way before during Obama years when. Under Hillary Clinton, who proposed this pivot to Asia, right? That's when, like, the pivot to Asia wasn't really an economic pivot. It was a military pivot. it was reorienting the U.S. security alliances and resources in Asia to contain China. And now we have the so-called Quad, the Indo-Pacific Quad, you know, the alliance of democracies between Japan, U.S., Australia, and India to contain China, and against all this background, all this incipient Cold War with China, now we have, you know, Hong Kong as a flashpoint, because in places like Hong Kong, in China's peripheries, and also with Uyghur issue in China's Xinjiang region, U.S. finds like kind of China's soft underbelly, that, you know, these problem areas that U.S. can potentially cause some domestic disturbances for China, so you know, China can't be bothered elsewhere. I mean, that's I think the big picture.
I guess in closing, you know, because we're going to get accused. I know you've been accused on Twitter of being too friendly to China, but I've also heard you be critical of China on podcasts like the Radio War Nerd with John Dolan and Mark Ames. So maybe you could clear that up for my listeners who are still, you know, probably going to be, he's defending China and he hates the Hong Kong protesters.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I have been always very clear on my stance. I hate censorship, right? There's no way I'm going to defend Chinese censorship. I'm always critical of Chinese censorship. I think it's stupid, counterproductive, and it's really unnecessary. And the other gripe I have against the Chinese government, it's very intrusive to you know, to a lot of people's life, because, you know, China still have this mindset of you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, China is no longer communist, is no longer socialist. That's not quite true, because China still have very much this mindset of implementing like the scientific Marxism. For that, what it meant was, you know, Chinese government, it feels it needs to shape to social engineer, right? Carry out social engineering project inside the country to shape the way the society is going to shape.
Do you mean things like the social credit system there, which I've heard a lot of scary stories about that?
Okay, social credit system is overblown in Western media, because that there was like a point of time where there's a report on social media on social credit system all over Western media, but recently it was debunked by Western media. like now there's a disclaimer, so okay, actually social credit system is not what we say we are, but it doesn't matter, but because the initial mean of social credit system already got out. So now when people talk about China, they talk about social credit system. So I have been to China. I just went to China for a 2-month tour. So I can tell you that the social credit system that was talked up by the Western media does not exist in China. What does exist is there is a lot of surveillance, so that there's no doubt about that. I mean, every Chinese city I've been to, there's a lot of there's like security camera everywhere. I mean, as of now, they have been mostly used for like traffic issuing traffic tickets, right? So I mean, it doesn't mean that they can't be potentially misused, but as of now, it's mostly for issuing traffic tickets, but there are everywhere. It's true. The cameras are everywhere, and you even see the signs that you're entering an area that's being monitored and blah blah blah. So that part is true. And you know, I just don't like the heavy handedness of the Chinese government sometimes, because they, a lot of times, rather than you know, devoting the time and the resource to tackle a problem, they would you know, issue a blanket ban. You know, for example, like the scooters, right? The like a simple issue, like right now there's a scooter ban or a coming scooter ban in many Chinese cities. You know, or 'cause scooter is a very cheap source for people to get around. And in fact, at one point to lessen the environmental impact, the Chinese government actually provided subsidies for people to switch to electric scooters. So if you go to China right now, a lot of Chinese cities, they just mostly it's all run on electric scooters, which I think is great. It's, you know, it's more friendly to the environment than the gas power model, because I'm in Bali, Indonesia. It's gas power scooters, motorbikes everywhere. And asking around, people tell me, oh, because the electric version is actually costs much more than the gas power version. That's why everybody uses gas power version. So I appreciate that they have the electric scooters in China, but now there's talking about bans of scooters in cities, because supposedly, you know, there's still high incidence of traffic accidents that, you know, that the local government finds unacceptable. But I mean, yeah, like people, rather than devoting, say, money to, you know, driver education, blah, 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 you know, government just find it easier, just ban it. Just ban it. I mean, like, without regard to thinking of the impact it's going to have on people's lives. Because right now, like, scooter is super convenient for a lot of people, especially for people, lower income people who can't afford to have cars for their family. And that's just one small example. There's, like, tons of other example how, you know, another example is the ban on raising pigs. So, you know, Xi Jinping recently, they have they launched a campaign to clear up the environment in China, right? Because, you know, the Chinese air quality, the water quality has gotten pretty bad until recently. So in the last few years, there was a big campaign you know, launched by Xi Jinping himself to like clear up the environment in China. And what it gets translated to on the ground is, you know, they now ban raising pigs and ducks and chicken because they supposedly pollute the water source. But raising pigs, chicken and ducks traditionally have been income source for a lot of, you know, individual Chinese farmers, and now they're all just being banned. I mean, like, the another driver for the ban was the African swine flu that was affecting the Chinese pig population, and it became a problem because like a lot of the farmers, rather than disposing their diseased pigs, because it would cost money to send those pigs to those centers to be destroyed. So what they do is they just toss dead pigs into the river. And what happened was, like, hundreds and thousands of pig carcasses starting to show up floating down river around Shanghai, right? And now it became a big news, big scandal, because, you know, Shanghai has you try to protect its image as a shining cosmopolitan city. You can't have dead pigs floating down the river. So that was another reason for this blanket ban of raising pigs in the countryside. And I mean, it's not a straight ban, but they require very strict health inspection, but which really meant like the small farmers who normally keep one or two pigs in their family, they won't be able to afford that health inspection for the pigs. So they have to give up pig raising. Only large, you know, corporate farming that you know can have the only those industrial pig farms that have the capital that could afford the rigorous health inspection could continue operation. And you know, but that does affect, you know, livelihood of a lot of Chinese people. And now with the trade war with U.S., because before China imported a lot of pork from U.S., especially, you know, with African swine flu virus decimating the Chinese pig herds. Now with the tariff being raised on the American pork, now there's a shortage of pork in Chinese market. So now the government is trying to encourage farmers to raise pigs again after banning them for like a year or two. So, I mean, these are kind of things that happen in China, a lot of administrative stuff. Sometimes these policies are kind of whimsical, to say the best, you know, just like without consideration for the impact on people. These are the things I am more upset about, because those actually have real impact on people and you know, I really, really don't like censorship. I must say, I really, really don't. Because I think on the receiving end of that, I had a 5 million follower Weibo account at one point, and it was just suspended for I don't even know what reason, because it never gave me a reason why it was banned. And yeah.
Well, I guess in closing, I wanted to get your final thoughts on the Hong Kong protests, and also how my listeners can listen to your podcast, Silk and Steel.
Yeah, just Google the Silk and Steel podcast. You will find it. The first or the second link will be my Patreon account. So how I normally put all the free episodes on the Podbean, which is a link to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, etc. And then for the premium episodes, it's only on my Patreon account for people who subscribe to my Patreon. It's you know, for $5 a month, you can get some subscriber only content plus newsletters every month. And the podcast primarily, like I said, primarily focus on China, history, culture, politics, current affairs, everything. Yeah. And you can Google my name, Carl Zha. That's spelled with a C, C-A-R-L, last name Z-H-A, Zebra Henry Apple. And you'll probably find my Twitter account that will show up. I tweet a lot. I'm extremely online. And also I think my podcast will show up as well, the Patreon links.
And like I said, is there anything you would want listeners to take away in regards to our discussion about the Hong Kong protests? If you could just sum it up, what yes. your final thoughts on it are.
Yes, so I support peaceful protests, right? I do think, you know, Hong Kongers, they have the right to peaceful assembly. But what I've seen right now is the protest has really degenerated into just vandalism and escalation into violence, and I think, you know, protesters, no matter what your which side you are on, you know, you have to think about how is your tactics going to be effective, right? Like any kind of goal of political movement, you want to bring in as many people to support your cause as possible. But what the Hong Kong protesters are doing right now is they're alienating a lot of people by attacking public infrastructure like the train stations and trains, and basically generally making working class Hong Kongers' life miserable by blocking their commute. And they're not really winning hearts and minds right now in Hong Kong. I mean, for a core of protesters, they will always support the protest no matter what. But there's, you know, they need to win over the silent majority out there, and I don't think that's happening right now. If anything, they're alienating more people as the protest itself is turning more radical. And you also have to think about what your end game is, right? I mean, you know, I think nobody can argue against democracy and freedom, right? But one part of democracy is compromise, right? To have a compromise where, if not all the demands, but partially satisfy all parties on all sides. And you know that, you know, it's one thing, it's glorious to have a revolution, to have a struggle, but to actually build a working democracy, compromise is key. And I think that's getting lost in the current climate. And right now, you know, like if the protester right now, they already scored a major victory by having the Hong Kong government formally withdraw the extradition bill. Regardless whether the extradition bill itself is good or bad, or you know, is the move is justified or not, that was one of the major demands. I mean, they could have taken this opportunity, declare victory, right, and use this chance to build up political capital and political organizations for to push for more electoral reforms down the road. Rather than that, now they're trying to, you know, just push forward with their, continue to escalate to push for all their demands to be met. I don't see that's happening, to be honest. And I don't think China, contrary to people's expectations, I don't think China is in a hurry to sending its PLA to Hong Kong to crack down the protests, because what's the point right now? Hong Kong protest is a storm in the teacup. That's Hong Kong. It's affecting Hong Kong specifically. That protest will not spread to mainland China precisely because a lot of the rhetorics and action of the Hong Kong protester have alienated majority of the mainland Chinese by, you know, calling the names and beating up mainland tourists and et cetera. And right now the cost of sending in like a PLA into Hong Kong, do a Tiananmen 2.0 style crackdown, it's just way too much versus letting Hong Kong protest burn itself out. And I think that's probably what's going to happen. And what's probably going to happen is, you know, the movement will continue to radicalize and until it alienates more and more people. And you know, like how long can the protest go on? You know, you potentially could even go on as long as the yellow vest protests in France, but as we can see in France already, the yellow vest movement was losing steam. Granted, it was been a lot longer, but this is what we could be looking at. It's continue protesting Hong Kong, especially with some section of the U.S. government pie has no interest of seeing it dying down anytime soon. They will probably continue to abet and help encourage escalation from the sidelines and working on the inside. And the tension will continue to simmer. The Hong Kong government will probably try to muddle through. But overall, we'll just have to wait and see. But I don't see any kind of Tiananmen 2.0 scenario playing out.
Well, I appreciate your insights, Carl Jia of the Silk and Steel podcast. I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Carl Jia of the Silk and Steel podcast. What is your take on the Hong Kong protests, folks? I really would like to hear from you. You know, I'm just an ignorant yank covering this. I have an interest in it. And I want to hear a lot of other views on the topic of the Hong Kong protests. So any recommendations for guests that can provide other views on the protests would be very much welcome. By the way, listeners, new episode of Parallax Views After Hours up on the Patreon, featuring Matthew Alford on what the mainstream media won't tell you about Western foreign policy. It's a good one, folks. Check it out. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.